introduce our speaker tonight. It's Nick from Columbus, New Jersey.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nick Jerzyk. I'm an alcoholic.
And,
good to be here. Thanks, Dave, for asking me. It's always an honor to be in front of a podium, in front of a bunch of alcoholics. Years ago, I was in your rooms, and I was taking up your time and doing the darndest job I can to try and impress you with what knowledge I had. And not really you, like the good-looking girls. That's who I was trying to impress. But not that you guys are actually you're actually a good-looking bunch. I'll tell you what, my very first AA meeting ever, I didn't even, like, the only reason why I knew it was an AA meeting is because my father's an alcoholic and he dragged me along, but other than that, I would have thought it was like bingo night, you know, like, it was dreary and 90 years old was the average, you know, attendee, and, you know, my judgment based upon that first, you know, minute of walking in that room was, I don't belong here. My job is to tell you a little bit, in a general way, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And, I was instructed that whenever I'm at a podium, I'm supposed to tell you three things. And one is that I have a sobriety date, and that's September 9th, 2004, that I have a sponsor, and he's got a sponsor. And that I've been blessed enough to been able to show some guys what's been working for me. I truly feel like that's probably the only reason why I'm still around, you know, because I don't do half this stuff as consistent as I try to do that, you know, just trying to show up and help out. And that was beaten into my brain from day one, you know, with this guy that I started talking to. He said that the only way this is going to work for me is if it does work, to keep showing, you know, keep passing the message, and then I have to make it priority. And like I said, I really haven't done anything else in this program as consistently as I've done that. And I think that's why I'm still here, you know. And I also have a home group. We meet in Columbus, New Jersey at 8:30 on Friday nights. And if you're ever in Columbus, New Jersey at 8:30 on a Friday night, after you ask yourself, what the heck am I doing here, come to our meeting. We'd love to have you. My home group has always been a very, very near and dear thing to me and my sobriety. I feel like you should think your home group is the best group within driving distance to you. And my home group's about an hour away from where I live. And I probably pass 20 meetings to get there on a Friday night. But it's not as good, you know. It's actually quite like this group. The people that greeted me were nice and enthusiastic, it looked like anyway. And that's what I think my group is, enthusiastic about this program, enthusiastic about the 12 steps, enthusiastic about God, and enthusiastic about watching people grow and have these enlightening spiritual experiences. And and so I got sober in Newark, Delaware, at a group just like this, you know, 1 hour, one speaker meeting. And then I moved back to New Jersey about a year and a half later. And after trying to crusade and tell everybody, in AA that they're not doing it the right way, and as AA should, you know. Eventually, I found a couple like-minded people, and we started a meeting, 1 hour, one speaker group down in Barnegat, New Jersey. Some of you have been there. Keep the resentment in the coffee pot going, and we started something out in Columbus, and that's where my home is right now. The common thread has always been the message. You know, the message that I picked my home group to carry, like, not me pick, my home group should carry the message that, you know, that I'd like it to carry. So I pick the groups that carry that message, and that message is, I think, pretty similar to this group's, you know, that hope is here. That hope is here, that this is supposed to be fun, you know, that this isn't something that like, you know, is like some of the meetings that I've attended in, you know, before where, you know, this looks hard. You know, it looks hard and it's kind of unattractive, you know. My home groups have always, at least to me, been attractive. That's what I'm trying to say. So anyway, it actually caught me on a pretty good time. I just got back from a men's retreat this weekend and feel really good spiritually. And that's in the past year, I've gotten engaged. I bought a house and I started a business. And you know, as cliche as it sounds, the things that AA gives you, you know, if you put that in front of AA, you're going to suffer. And I got that experience recently, you know, in the past year. You know, these gifts that God has given me, like unbelievable, like the woman that's going to become my wife, I don't deserve, you know. The house that I live in and the job that I do, like, I couldn't have picked it better. You know, I just, it's, they are great gifts from God. And, what I did was, you know, kind of put, for a little bit of time, I kind of made business my number one priority and my relationship my number one priority and fixing this house up my number one priority, and AA slipped. And, my heart wasn't as full. I wasn't ready to take a drink. I really haven't had that urge to drinks in a while, in a long time, and I'll tell you how that happened and when that happened. But I really didn't have the urge to take a drink. It's just that the quality of my life wasn't as good as when I was out every single night looking for a new guy to help, picking up a couple guys and you know, picking up, putting them in the car, talking about fourth step, you know, crazy sexual fourth step, stupid stuff, and then God, and then, you know, crimes we committed, and then God, you know, like. That's awesome fun to me. And so I guess I'll start. I don't like telling a whole lot about my drinking, my drunk a lot. You know, I feel like if you're in this room and you're an alcoholic, you kind of know what it's like to suffer from alcoholism. You know, and I know there's many definitions of what an alcoholic is, and I just like to go by what was shown to me, what was taught to me, you know, and it's a bunch of different things, you know. When I start drinking, I can't tell you when I'm going to stop. When I stop drinking, I can't tell you when I'm going to start again. You know, my drinking becomes very unpredictable, and I drink when I don't want to drink. You know, that's kind of sums it up for me. But I didn't really know all that. You know, I kind of learned that from somebody else, you know, and saw it in, through my life in hindsight. I will tell you a little bit about my life before I ever picked up a drink, like 5 minutes before I picked up a drink. I was 5 minutes before I ever picked up. The reason why I talk about 5 minutes is because I'm quite certain that I had a problem before I ever picked up that drink or drug. I'm quite certain that there was something there that I was trying to fix, and that I found the fixer, you know, when I picked up that drink. I found the answer to the problem I didn't even know I had, you know, or what to call it. I knew it was there. Believe me, I knew it was there. I walked around with it for 15 years, you know. And what that problem felt like was, it felt like a big giant hole in my heart. And what it sounded like was, you know, somebody explained it. I don't even know. I can't even give anybody credit, but I think it's actually Timmy H from Boston. The radio that has like static coming through, you know, like, and then you take that drink and then it's just, you get it to the right channel and it's no static whatsoever, you know. My head instinctually, naturally goes a million miles a minute. Like what goes into goes on in my brain, I could think 300 thoughts in a 60-second period of time. And, you know, a lot of that is fear. You know, a lot of that is projecting fear, you know, fear-based things. And, you know, so I got this head that races and won't stop and won't shut up and this hole in my heart. And, you know, that particular day when I was 15 years old, we all broke into this guy's house. He was on vacation. Him and his family were on vacation, so we knew that this was kind of like a safe place to go and drink. And all my other friends had drank before. And I kind of was the last one because both of my parents are recovering alcoholics. And they were when I was 15. They both have like 20-something years in the program. And I grew up thinking alcohol was Satan's spit. You know, like my parents kind of instilled it upon me that alcohol was like the worst thing in the world. Like you can smoke pot, but don't drink alcohol. You know, like alcohol is terrible. And so I was the last one of my friends to drink. And I remember it was very, very similar to any other day. You know, that fear and that emptiness. The fear was quite like any other day, which was like, am I going to do this right? What are these people going to think of me? You know, what do you think of me? That's basically my fear. You know, when I sat down and did a fifth step with my sponsor, we kind of looked at my fear. We found like three columns, you know, three different categories. I'm going to lose something that I have that I think I need. I'm going to not get something that I really want and think I need. And the other thing is what you people think of me. Like those are my main fears in this world, and you know that's what's going on in my brain at 15 years old, in my heart. And you know, fast forward 15 minutes later, and the radio goes to, you know, no static, and the brain just kind of quiets down, and that heart feels full. And again, I just found the answer to whatever it is I was looking for. You know, didn't have a word, a name for the problem. You know, kind of subconsciously was looking for whatever would work, and I just found it, you know. And the way I thought from moment one was, if this much made me feel like this, how good am I going to feel when I drink this much, you know, which was the demise of that weekend. You know, I got, you know, threw up in this kid's house, and we got found out, and, I don't remember exactly what my punishment was, but it was worth it. Whatever it was worth it, you know. And I don't remember if consciously or subconsciously I made a decision, but I definitely made a decision that this is good, and I'm going to do it as often as I can. And that's kind of what I, you know, in the beginning I had tons of fun and little consequences, you know, grounded for a month, or no cell phone, no TV, whatever it was, for marking period, whatever it was nothing, you know, like I would trade it in a heartbeat, and I would go out and, you know, sneak out at night and get drunk or get high. At the end of my drinking, there was no fun, and there was a lot of consequence. It completely flip-flopped. And, you know, throughout my drinking career, it was apparent to me, it was apparent to my parents, that there was an issue, there was a problem. You know, I remember my mom found, like, a letter I was writing to one of my ex-girlfriends who just broke up with me. I was going to kill myself if, you know, we didn't get back together, whatever it was. And I don't know how many people write that, but she was concerned, and you know, I was acting out. My friends had changed. My grades had changed. You know, all the typical signs of an adolescent who's kind of straying. And they started taking me to doctors and therapists and psychiatrists and stuff like that. And they also started catching me here and there with drugs and paraphernalia and alcohol. And they also knew that I was predestined, you know, predisposed to this genetic disease. So, you know, so my parents love me very much, and they were trying the best they can to get me help, you know, and the best they knew how to get me help. And I don't know if they ever invited me to an AA meeting or not, but they certainly invited me to a lot of doctor's offices. And, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'll go to a doctor and I'll tell him anything he wants. You know, I pretty much size him up in about 5 minutes and tell you whatever you want to hear. And all these people, you know, whether it was several, it was, you know, anybody who kind of had an authority figure on me, like a cop or a judge or a therapist or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or my parents, whoever it was always telling me, Nick, you have a drinking problem. Nick, you have a drinking problem. And it made sense up here. You know, it made sense that I'm getting in trouble because I'm not allowed to drink, and I am, you know. But in here, it was like, you guys don't understand. Like, the only thing that makes me feel okay is when I'm drunk or high. And so I was like, you know, I'll do whatever you want, but I can't give this stuff up. I don't want to. Like, it's not even an option. And if the only way I'm getting out of this office is by telling you that I'll stop, well, then be prepared to get lied to. You know, I'll tell you, but I'm not going to stop. You know, it's not happening. And one of these guys, I think I was like 16 years old. My parents took me to a couple therapists and a couple counselors and stuff like that. And they finally got me. They heard about this guy who was he was not your average doctor. And so they took me to this guy. He was up in Tom's River. It's about a half hour away from where we live. And I remember walking in this guy. It was a building. It was like industrial building. And I walked up into this office, and it was filled with smoke. And I heard this guy like yelling. And I walk in. I open his office, and he's like, "Oh, my next appointment's here. Get the heck out of here." And he's like, you know, the family and the kid who was just in there just, like, scurried out. And he's like, "Sit the F down." And I saw he's like, chain-smoking. He's got two packs of Salems and four, like, 24-ounce Wawa coffees right next to him. And, you know, I didn't say much that first visit. I just remember him, like, cursing a lot and... you know, he told my mom that, you know, she was doing a terrible job because she was enabling me, and that if she really loved me and she really wanted to see me get better, then she'd kick my ass out. And then he went on to my dad, and then he went on to me, and he went off on me. You know, like he told me about me. And I certainly didn't want to hear that. So I remember leaving his office and, like, "Mom, Dad, this guy's Looney Tunes, you know, like, let's keep trying, you know. This guy is obviously not our guy." And what ended up happening was 18 years old, I got kicked out of my parents' house a while ago, and you know, went to all the friends that I had and stayed at their houses for a little bit of periods of time until, you know, I wore out my welcome at each one of those houses. And then eventually my girlfriend's parents let me stay there for a couple nights, and they were like, "Listen, my daughter," you know, I was dating a 16-year-old, and they're like, "Listen, our daughter's 16, you're 18, like, this isn't going to work out, you know." So I had nowhere to go, and so I went back to my parents, and they're like, "Listen, you can stay here for a couple of days, but on Thursday, but on Sunday, you're leaving. Like, I don't care where you go, but you're leaving." And what I did was, I remembered back to a couple of years before when I was 16, and I called this guy, this doctor guy, you know, the smoke-filled room with four cups of coffee. I called him up and I said, "John, I'm getting kicked out and I have nowhere to go. I don't know what to do. I don't care. You know, I just need some help. And I really wanted help. You know, and I didn't care if I had to put down the drink or the drug. I just didn't, I wasn't raised that way, the way I was living. And I didn't want to do it anymore. I just didn't know what to do. And I have no idea why I remembered and called this guy, you know, at the time. In hindsight, I could tell you, and I will tell you. But he said, you know, come on up and come see me. I said, dude, I don't have a penny to my name. He said, I don't care, just come up. And so I went up there, and he's like, all right, so when are you getting kicked out? I'm like, Sunday. He's like, all right, I have a plane leaving for Utah at Sunday at 1 p.m. with six other guys just like you, and they're all going out to this like rehab. Basically, they're forming a rehab. Like, they're all the guinea pigs of this new rehab. And yeah, he made it sound way better than that. But he could have literally said that, and I would have been like, all right, man, I don't care, whatever. But there was a catch. It cost $32,000. And I was like, dude, good luck. You know, like, my parents are, they're going to hang up the phone, you know, in 2 seconds when you call them. He's like, give me a shot. And so a couple days later, I was on that plane. And I went out to Utah, and it was probably the greatest experience of my life. Like, you know, the first week I was, you know, sleeping out in the desert, you know, and, you know, cursing God and cursing the world and like, F this, you know. They had a curse. They had a cursing rule. Like, you can't curse. F your effing cursing rule. But, you know, after like a week or so, I kind of realized that this was like, this was awesome. Like, it's kind of like a reality show without cameras. You know, get six alcoholics, seven alcoholics from New Jersey, like Jersey Shore. You know, get them out in the desert, put them out in the desert, and have them get from point A to point B, you know, in 28 days. And somewhere along the way, they have to learn about God and learn about, you know, or get in touch with some sort of spirit. There was like a, you know, Native American. There was a wilderness guru, you know, taught us how to make candles out of like earwax. It was awesome, you know. And then there was two guys in recovery. You know, those were our four counselors. And you know, what I took out of that, as far as like what I can apply to my life after I got out of there, was that I should go to AA. You know, and I think that's similar to what most people find out in any rehab that they go to. You know, I was like, after you get out of here, go to AA, find a home group, get a sponsor, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Whatever, you know, the same stuff. You know, I just, my parents paid $32,000, and I went out to Utah to hear that. And so that's what I did, because I really wanted to stop. I really I definitely didn't want to not have a place to live. That's actually what it was. So I remember, I was actually just thinking about this the other day. I remember my parents picked me up from the airport, and it still hasn't been determined if I'm going to come back to live with them or not. But I'm, you know, really hoping that that's going to be the case. And they had the same idea. They just had conditions, you know, that I had to start going to AA. I'm willing to do that. But I hadn't seen my girlfriend in a month, you know, so we get back to my, from JFK to my house in southern New Jersey. It was like a 2-hour drive, and I get back there, and I called my girlfriend, and she came over, and she was over for like 15 minutes, and my dad's like, all right, ready to go? I'm like, ready? The AA meeting, Dad? Like, it's my first day back. Technically, we were at an AA, technically I was at an AA meeting this morning, you know, like in Utah. And he's like, no, man, this is the deal, you know. And then I went to that bingo night. And I did what I was told, you know, and what I was told was to raise my hand and say I was new and to tell you people I needed a home group and that I needed help and, you know, whatever else. And and, you know, when it talks about and how it works, how it says A, B, and C. You know, B, that we were alcoholic, or A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own life. B, that no human power could relieve my alcoholism. That's pretty much the theory that I had to test for the next 4.5 years. You know, I was still looking for some sort of something, some sort of power, human power, material, worldly power that could take this away. You know, as far as the God thing was concerned, I wasn't sure, but, you know, I wasn't sure if there was a God or what he was or whatever, but I was pretty sure that if I did these stupid steps, that I wouldn't get what you were talking about. You know, like that at the end of the appendix spiritual experience, you know, the contempt prior to investigating, that was me. You know, I'll write a fourth step. You know, I'll write you my life story. And at the end, now the only thing that's going to be different is you're going to know my life story. You know? So I was pretty sure that because there was no, like, win the lottery step or trophy blonde, you know, girlfriend step, that these were not for me. And so for the next 4.5 years, that's what I did. I mean, I came to AA and I spent a couple months here and got well versed in the big book. And, like I said, I tried my damnedest to impress the girls, you know, with the knowledge that I could tell you I had. And after 6 months, I remember I went to my 6 month anniversary. We do coins. I don't know if you guys do coins, but we do coins. I got a coin on my six month, and they get the coin in the beginning of the meeting. And I got my coin and I left the meeting. And, actually I didn't, I got my coin and I went out to have a cigarette, cause that was like really, you know, getting in front of people and saying, you know, a 1 minute spiel on what I did for the past 6 months, that was like, you know, stressful. So I went outside and had a cigarette. I went out, had a cigarette. While I was out there, somebody called me on my phone, and they asked me the wrong question. You know, there was a party at so-and-so's house, and, you know, she hasn't been around for 2 years or whatever, so why don't you come over? And I left that meeting, and that was, you know, that was basically the pattern for the next couple of years. Is I'd come in and get a couple months here, a couple weeks there. I'd go to a million freaking meetings. I swear I've been to a million meetings, and I've been to all different kinds of meetings, speaker meetings and 12 tradition meetings and 12 step meetings and big book meetings. I was a meeting freaking maker, you know? And, eventually at the end, I moved down to Delaware because I was pretty sure that the Division of Motor Vehicle in New Jersey was my problem. So I went down there and I used my first initial for my last name as my middle initial and got a license in Delaware. You know? So instead of Nick Jerzik, my name was Nick J. Erzik. And I am a good thinker, you know. So I get my license, and, you know, things are going great. And I have, at this point, I'm drinking by myself. I'm getting high by myself. I can't hold a job. I can't open my mail. I can't leave to go get cigarettes without opening the blinds and making sure there was none of my neighbors outside. And my neighbors were all Latin American because I lived in a motel gondola type thing. Gondola. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, it was in like the Wilmington, Delaware ghetto, and you know, I'd been to rehab, I'd been to jail. But these are the consequences that I'm paying now. I can't look people in the eye. I can't have a conversation with my mother. You know, I certainly can't have a conversation with a stranger. You know, I'm pretty sure I have nothing to offer the world. I remember, looking at my cell phone, my mom's calling me, like 17 missed calls from the past 3 days, and they're all from my mom, and looking at it again and being like, oh, I just can't answer that one, because of how I felt in here. That hole got so much bigger, and it was so much harder to fill. And that head was, it was very, very loud. And, I was alone, and nothing dramatic or drastic happened. God blessed me with desperation. God blessed me with, all right, you're completely out of ideas. Is there anything else that I could think of that would make me happy? Because if there is, I would have tried it. The girl, the car, the money, the job, the state, the license, the clothes, the music, whatever it was, whatever plan I had, that if I just had this, if I just got this, if I got rid of this, if I just went there, if she just did this, I tried every single one of them. And here I am alone with a gaping hole in my soul and a head that won't shut up again. And so I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to speed this up. I go to my first AA meeting, first meeting back in like a year, and it's 8:05. I'm definitely not going on time or even before. So it's 8:05. I walk in, and there's three dudes in this meeting, and they're all 75 years old. And it's 8:05, so I'm definitely like, no one else is coming. And it's a discussion meeting. So like, he shares, and it's 8:09. And I certainly have 51 minutes worth of spiritual dumping to do, and 5 minutes into that cry fest, they're like, listen, man, there's a meeting that starts at 9:00 right up the road. It's a little bit more well attended. Why don't you go up there? And so I went up there, and I don't remember anything that anybody said, but I do remember at the end of the meeting, we all let go of each other's hands, and there was a guy from me to the exit sign, and he just bolted right to me. And he's like, how you doing? My name's Kevin. Are you new? And he knew I was new. It was a rhetorical question. there was people at the coffee pot, and there was somebody telling jokes over there, and there was really good-looking women over there. And this guy was looking me dead in the eye, and he really wanted to know how I was doing. And he was waiting in for an answer after the answer that I gave him, which was fine, He was waiting for another answer, the real answer. And the reason why I talk about this is because it's huge. I try to remember it every meeting I go to because, at the end when people were asking me, is this anybody's first meeting here or is this anybody's first meeting back, I wasn't even bothered raising my hand, because I was ashamed. I've been here before. I already did the whole thing where I wanted everybody to think I knew something. Like, I just kind of want to sit in the back and hopefully somebody's going to give me that nugget, that I could just change my life. Somebody will just say a one-liner, and it'll change my world. And so I remember that because it was really, really freaking hard for me to talk to people. And I can't imagine I'm the only one, only new guy, that's hard to talk to people, And so what this guy did, this guy Kevin, was he made it so easy to be, to get introduced into that location's Alcoholics Anonymous by approaching me, And so I try not to wait for new guys to approach me today. I have to go and look for people that I don't recognize that come to my home group, And you'd be surprised how many new guys there are. Kevin asked me to go out to coffee. I have something better to do. If you were to ask me at this point what my belief in God was, it would be little, if any. And what happened was the next day I went to the junkyard to buy a part for my illegal car that I was driving under the revoked list with a made-up name on my driver's license with. And Kevin was at the junkyard at this time, you know, on this day, the day after I met him. And I was like, it's got to mean something, you know. And so I asked Kevin at the junkyard to be my Valentine, I mean my sponsor. That's what it feels like, man, when you're a new guy. You know, I'm 22 years old, I'm a guy, and, you know, I got to ask this man for help. That's what it feels like. It feels like I'm asking him to dance. It's real hard to do. So he says yes, and for the next 6 months, I'm in his car, and we're going to meetings every single night. I'm a meeting maker, man. I make meetings. I can make meetings. And every single time I get sober, things get better. Like, don't get me wrong. I physically get better. I get some more money in my pocket. I get a girlfriend and a car somehow, you know. I get a job, you know. Like, things definitely get better on the outside. And this time was no different. You know, I'm 6 months sober. I'm the manager at Blockbuster. Except for now, my sponsor is making me be honest, so I'm the manager that rides his bike to Blockbuster. And it is pretty funny. I got some money in my pocket. I got some potential girls, you know. I moved out of that Mexican hotel, and like all that stuff happened, and the newness of all that stuff has kind of wore off now. You know, it's 6 months over. The newness of the new job and the new car and the new girl and the new money and the new clothes, it wore off, and now it's back to that hole and it's back to that head. And you know, I already called everybody in my phone and told them I was sober, so nothing really else, like nobody else, and I could tell that too. And so I'm getting to that point again where I got to make a decision, and my decision was clear. You could either continue to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, or you can experience some relief, experience some sort of fun. You know, that's what goes on in my brain at 6 months over without doing any work. You know, I'm going to meetings. I promise you, I'm going to meetings. And what ends up happening is my sponsor, and God bless him, I mean, he got me in, and he got me to stay in for at least 6 months. But him and his guys were, they were talking about this meeting, you know, in Newark, Delaware. And those people are crazy. You know, there's shenanigans going on at that meeting. Don't go to that meeting, Nick. I went to that meeting. You know? And here's a perfect example of where my shortcomings may be my greatest, you know, God may be using them. And so my defiance, I went to this meeting and I heard like what I needed to hear for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I probably heard it a million times, but I heard it that night. And the way this man talked, he talked about the way he felt and the way he thought. He didn't really talk a whole lot about his situation because he told me why at the end, you know, eventually he told me why he doesn't really talk about his situational life stuff. And it's because not everybody can relate to how many DUIs he had. You know, like the newcomer, if I didn't have any DUIs, then you tell me you had 10, and maybe I don't belong here. You know, or if you shot, you know, if your liver went and, you know, mine's perfectly fine, then maybe I don't belong here. You know, that kind of stuff. But if he tells me that he had a hole in his heart and a head that won't shut up, and he described it in different ways, boy, I knew exactly what he was talking about. And I belong here. You know, where this meeting, I belong here. And then he said the most important thing that he said that night at the end was, if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're not having fun, you're doing something wrong. And I wasn't even close to having fun. So at the end of the meeting, I went up and introduced myself to him, and he played guitar. He said something about the guitar, and I'm 6 months sober. I still have, like, no social skills. You know, like, I cannot talk to anybody. I can't look people in the eye. I'm still, like, so insecure, so fearful. I'm still so concerned about what people think of me that I'm trying to say the right thing and I don't say anything at all because I'm thinking too hard, you know. And so I walk up to him and I'm like, so you play guitar? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, I play guitar too. He's like, all right, dude, let's go jam in my house. It's right there. Like, see the house right there? I'm like, yeah. He's like, let's go right now, right there. And I'm like, all right. And I went over there, picked up a guitar, put it down 30 seconds later, and just started crying to this guy. I told him I don't know how to live. I don't know if I want to live or die. I don't know if I want to stay sober or not. You know, I just don't want to feel the way I'm feeling. You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not working. And he asked me one question, and that question was, have you ever been through the 12 steps fully as outlined through the big book? My answer was, well, before I answer that, let me give you my theory on the third step. And he chuckled and said, look, we don't have theories in here. We do it. You know, don't even matter if you can recite these to me or not, you know, or if you can define them to me or not. If you did them, then answer yes. But if you didn't, then we have somewhere to go, you know. And I didn't. And the other thing, this is another, like, pivotal point in my sobriety. For the first time in 4.5 years, probably not, but it's a good story when I say it from the podium. but as far as I can remember, for the first time in 4.5 years, I just made myself vulnerable to another Alcoholics Anonymous member, and he didn't point the finger and tell me I need to go do this. You need to go to more meetings. Double up on your meetings. Get a commitment at this group. Or, you know, he didn't tell me what to do. What he said was, Nick, why don't you just start hanging out with us and watch what we do. And if it's attractive, I'll be more than happy to show you how we're doing it. And that was attractive in itself. That was more attractive than somebody pointing their finger and telling me, you need to go do this. Because just like somebody told me you need to not go to that meeting, I do whatever it is the opposite of what you just told me to do is, you know. And so that's exactly what I did. I just started watching this guy. I followed him around. I started going to meetings with him. And we started going to meetings like half an hour early. And I'd done that before, you know. But during that half hour, and then, like, we'd stay at half an hour late, during that hour period of time, he'd, like, pretend he didn't know me. Like, he'd, like, we'd get in the car, and then he'd be like, all right, you go over there, I'll go over here. And look for people that you don't recognize. Now look for people that might be new here tonight. And I'm like, well, I'm new. And he's like, well, you have 6 months. And we started talking about the doctor's opinion. So if someone's newer here than that, then you need to talk to them. You know, and if I come across anybody that's newer than that, I'll send them your way. And you could just tell them, you know, what you've been doing for the past 6 months, what's been working for you, what hasn't been, and, you know, what you've been doing in the past couple of days. And I'm like, all right, man. And so that's what was starting to happen. I started hanging out with this guy, and he made it abundantly clear that in order for this program to work. You've heard the term, you know, you got to give it away to keep it. This guy and the people that he was hanging around with were saying a little that, but a little skewed. They were saying you got to give it away to get it. You know, that this program is not about. It's not a selfish program. It's a selfless program. And he pointed out, he brought me to the word altruistic. He's like, you know what that means? I'm like, yeah. He's like, what does it mean? I'm like, all right, I don't know what it means. he made it abundantly clear that in order for this to continue to work, that if I started getting results based on the actions that I was taking, that I needed to pass it along in any way, shape, or form that I can. And, before we did any step work, he told me the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sitting there like, dude, I could care less about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just want to feel better, you know. And but he had a purpose to what he was doing. You know, he made it a point to let me know that the success of the Washingtonians and the success of the Oxford groups and the success of Alcoholics Anonymous was when they had one primary purpose. And the downfall of all three groups, and not the demise of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the demise of the Washingtonians and the Oxford group, was when they strayed away from that primary purpose. And that my primary purpose as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is to help other people, is to help the suffering alcoholic. And when I divert, I'll suffer. And when my group diverts, my group will suffer. And I've had experience with both. And so I'm like, all right, man, I'll do whatever the heck you want. You know, let's move on. Let's go to the next step. You know, step one, please. And we talked about the doctor's opinion. And, for the first time in 4.5 years, I found out what my problem was. You know, I was under the assumption that, an alcoholic, somebody who drinks a lot, and that if you put down alcohol, your life's going to be great. Makes sense to me, And this guy talked, he pointed out the doctor's opinion that this is a threefold disease. And that, the physical, when I put something in my body, I have this allergy that just kind of like, it's like primer, it gets the engine started. And that as soon as I put it in my body, I have this trigger that just goes. And the light switch that doesn't work, I just go. And that's my reaction to alcohol. And I understood that. And he said, we have this mental obsession. You could have 100 reasons why you shouldn't be going to get drunk, but as soon as that thought pops in your head that maybe tonight will be different, you just dwell on that until you go and actually put that first one in. And I understood that. He said, so that you got the mental and you got the physical. There's bad news, Nick. There's also good news. The bad news is that you have one more part of this disease. The good news is it's the only part you have to treat. And, he described his spiritual malady, and it was a lot like mine, The way he felt when it was a triangle of friends, those two friends were always better friends than me with either one of those guys, Always thinking about what other people thought of him, always had the fear, fear-based decisions, I'm basing my decisions on what I think I'm going to lose or what I think that you're going to take away from me or what I think I'm not going to get or what you think about me. That's what's running my life. And then he told me how it felt. And it felt just like that hole inside my heart. And so I know that, this guy's got whatever I got. And then he says, so here's the deal. There's a difference between a problem drinker and an alcoholic. The problem drinker puts down the drink, and his problem goes away. There's a problem. The drink puts it down, goes away. And the hopeless alcoholic, he's got that threefold disease. Where he puts down the drink, and he's just taking care of the physical. But that mental is going to want to get him back to that, back to that first drink. And more importantly, that spiritual, that's unbearable, And a guy like me... That's what happened. For 4.5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could take care of the physical. I could take care of putting down the drink. I'm really good at quitting drinking. I just can't stay quit, And I didn't know why. And this guy pointed, he made it abundantly clear that I had this mental obsession coupled with a spiritual malady. And that without treating the spiritual malady, I'm screwed. I'm always going to drink. It's what it says in my first step. I'm powerless. I will drink. And it's like I said, I don't know how many times I've heard it. I'm sure I've heard something to that nature in 5 years. But it was the first time I was actually hearing it, And maybe because he was saying it in such a loving way or describing it in such a way that I could understand, like, his lingo, his jargon. But whatever it was him taking his time out of his day, to sit down, give his time to an alcoholic, to a suffering alcoholic. And he promised me that he swore to me that the time that we were using, that we were taking with each other, was benefiting him more than it was me. And I could not understand that, because I felt great. Felt like a million bucks. Every time I walked out of his house, I felt like I was doing something. Finally, in Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody's giving me some direction, and I'm actually taking it. You know? And he's telling me it's benefiting him more than it is me. Couldn't understand it. Today I understand what he's talking about. You know, eventually I went through the rest of the steps. I had an awesome, awesome, awesome fifth step experience. I didn't tell my sponsor everything on my fourth step on purpose, because there was just some things I didn't want to tell. And you know, a couple weeks later, I found myself sitting in on a fourth step with him and another guy, and I knew that if that guy didn't get it off his chest, that he was going to drink. And then 1 second later, I thought, well, I didn't get it off my chest. So that guy left that night, and I was like, listen, man, I got something to tell you. I didn't do my fifth step properly. And I told him, and as soon as I told him, I swear, like, the vision, the sight that I saw changed, and nothing changed. You know, like the way, the feeling that overcame my body was like, Nick, God is here, and you're going to be all right. Just follow these people and do what they do, and you're going to be all right. And everything that happened in the past happened in the past, you know. And you know, that was my spiritual awakening, you know. And I consider it to be a little bit of both, you know, a little bit of the educational variety and a little bit of that shot, because, you know, as I was being told to try and help people. Here I am sitting in a four step after just doing one, trying to help this guy out. And in doing it, finding out that I didn't even do this right. You know, and then doing it and then feeling that feeling and seeing that whatever it was I saw. It was just like a glow. The world was glowing and it had color again. You know, and at the end of my drinking, my world was so tiny and it was so black and white. And now I'm, you know, I'm sitting in this guy's roof and, you know, the world has color again. And I feel from, you know, feel in my heart, that feeling that I was looking for in the bottle. A full heart, you know. And, all right, so I'm wrapping it up. I eventually do my 12 steps to the best of my ability. I make amends and I start helping people. And, you know, things are going great. And I meet a wonderful girl, and we get engaged, and we buy a house, and you know, I started a couple groups in New Jersey, and this stuff works. It really does. And what I can promise anybody here that looks at these steps and isn't convinced that it's going to work, what I can promise you is that you don't have to be convinced that it's going to work, because I wasn't convinced that this was going to work. And I felt like I had to be in order to move on. But what was promised to me is that it didn't matter what I believed in. You know, it didn't matter if I was convinced, or if I understood it. If I moved my feet first, if I moved my feet, I will get the results that all you other people got. And it doesn't matter what's going on up here, just move my feet. And that's all I did, man. I just followed the steps of the guy who went in front of me, and I got great results. And when I do that, when I follow the people in front of me, I still get great results. And when I think that looks like a shortcut, I end up coming back this way, you know. If you're an Alcoholics Anonymous and you're not having fun, you're doing something wrong. Thanks for letting me share.